WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In a few minutes, we'll hear the story of how George Bush secretly aided Saddam Hussein before the Gulf War. The story was recently broken in the Los Angeles Times by reporters Murray Wass and my guest Douglas Franz. We invited Franz to also talk about his new book, A Full-Service Bank, the story of BCCI, the Bank of Credit and Commerce. It was also known as the Bank of Crooks and Criminals because some of its best customers were drug dealers and terrorists. This is the first book about the BCCI scandal, but it's not a quickie. It was in the works long before the bank was closed down last summer. The book covers the history of BCCI and how it was started by a Pakistani banker who dreamed of creating the first Muslim-owned banking giant, a bank that could help third-world countries. The book also details the Customs Department's sting operation, Operation Sea Chase, that led to the first indictments against BCCI officials. I asked Douglas Franz to give a short history of the bank.
Well, Agha Hassan Abadi, who was a Pakistani banker, founded the bank in 1972. At that time, Pakistan was preparing to nationalize its banks, and Abadi had founded a bank in Pakistan called the United Bank of Pakistan, and he could see that it was going to be nationalized, and so he set about creating his own bank, and he had assistance from the Bank of America, which provided him both with the initial prestige and some money, and more importantly, he had the assistance of some Arab sheikhs, particularly Sheikh Zayed of Abu Dhabi, who had been customers of his at United Bank. And so he saw the handwriting on the wall. He saw that Bhutto, the prime minister of Pakistan, was going to nationalize banks. So he started up BCCI. He began it in Luxembourg, soon moved to London, later moved to the Cayman Islands. And it's our belief that from the outset, he intended to create a bank that was without borders, a bank that was offshore everywhere, so that he could avoid any kind of a nationalization problem. He'd been stung once with a bank he created. He didn't want to be stung again. I think that was his mindset at the outset.
So how did the BCCI change from a bank that saw itself as Muslim-oriented to help Muslim countries? How did it change from that to start functioning as a money launderer and working with terrorists?
Well, I think it became a natural progression of a bank that operated outside of the control and regulation of any single regulator. Basically, it was a bank without rules. And when you don't have any rules, that means you can do basically anything you want to do. So we see from the late 70s until the early 80s, the bank was growing like mad, and they were taking in deposits without asking any questions. It was in 1981 that they became the banker to Abu Nidal, probably the world's most violent and feared terrorist. And that was, you know, partly they wanted his money, partly they were also trying to prove their bona fides to their Islamic bankers, to the Arab sheikhs who backed them, because at that time Abu Nidal was working out of Iraq, and Iraq had just started the Iran-Iraq war, and so this was a way for BCCI, according to what Kasem told me, this was a way for BCCI to show that it was a strong Arab bank by supporting Abu Nidal and indirectly Iraq. Some of Abu Nidal's arms shipments certainly went to Iraq. You know, so that's how that started. And then there came a period in the mid-1980s when the bank was growing fast and it was trading in the commodities market. They had a small operation based in London that was trading heavily in the commodities operation. And by heavily, I mean they were basically wagering a million to $10 million on a single stock transaction, and they lost a huge amount of money. And they had to find a way to recoup that money that they'd lost. And so, therefore, they began to solicit more and more funds from the drug runners of the world, from Manuel Noriega, and from all sorts of operations like that.
What do you think were some of the BCCI's most innovative contributions to corruption?
that's a great question. I think that the single most innovative contribution was BCCI's ability to move dirty money all across the globe. by having these operations in 73 countries, you could go in to a BCCI office, say in Panama, as the Medellin cartel often did, regularly did. You could go into the BCCI office in Panama City, downtown there, and turn over $1 million, $10 million, $100 million in cash, and you could have it wired into a bank account any place in the country. Because once it gets into that international wire system, you can't tell the dirty money from the clean money. It's like dropping a drop of ketchup into 100 gallons of milk. You know, for an instant you can see it, but then it just disappears. And so basically it was a huge international laundering operation. And they did that for the people in Medellin cartel. They did it for Manuel Noriega. I suspect they did that for the Central Intelligence Agency. We certainly know that the CIA used BCCI to pay operatives around the world. And that's, you know, another form of laundering money. Whether that was, I don't think that was necessarily illegal. But that was one of BCCI's major contributions, I think.
Can I ask you for one of the more entertaining stories that you learned during your investigation of the BCCI? I mean, it's the kind of story that is perversely entertaining.
It's very entertaining, and I hope that the entertainment value isn't lost in the book. One of the things we tried to do was keep people entertained. Some of the best stories I think come out of the undercover operation. Bob Mazur, the customs undercover guy who spent about 2 years undercover operating to try and get first Colombian money launderers and ultimately the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, you know, he had some of those really close calls that all undercover operatives on television experience, but here it was right from the outset he faced that problem. Initially, the undercover operatives had set up an apartment in Tampa that they were going to use to monitor meetings with the Medellin cartel and later with bank officials as well. And they were setting up recording equipment there on the very night they had the first meeting with their first money launderer. And the money launderer insisted on going with another undercover operative to that apartment. And so as they were coming there, Mazur was still inside the apartment changing around some of the recording equipment, and he heard a key in the door. And so he dove into the closet, and he had to sit there and for hours while these two men had their conversation. And then the Colombian decided he wanted to sleep overnight in the apartment, and so he went to sleep about 2 a.m. in the bed, and Mazur waited until he could hear the regular sound of his breathing, and then had to crawl across the end of the bed out of the closet and slip out a second-story window.
The CIA had a report on the BCCI in 1986. They never even informed the Federal Reserve Bank, which regulates foreign banks seeking to operate here. Do you have any information about why the CIA basically sat on this?
Well, I don't have any hard conclusions about why. There's plenty of speculation about why. And I think the primary reason is that the CIA was using BCCI itself, not for illicit means, but to pay its operatives around the world. Here was a bank that was operating in every nasty corner of the globe, and that was perfect for the CIA to be able to pay off the people who were working for it. And so I think it was, in a sense, in the CIA's interest to keep this bank operating. And beyond that, I'm not sure why. We haven't seen evidence of corruption within the CIA. This was part of the bungling that the federal government did in the whole BCCI matter. I mean, it wasn't only the CIA that didn't tell the Federal Reserve what this bank was up to, the fact that it owned secretly First American Bank here in Washington, the biggest bank in the city. But, you know, it was the Federal Reserve failing to follow up on leads generated by Operation Sea Chase and the customs agents. It was the Justice Department failing to follow up on leads developed by the customs undercover operation. You know, we had that initial round of indictments in October 1988, and then this case sat dormant for 2 years. Nothing was done, and a lot of harm was done by BCCI to depositors around the world during that time period. I mean, the one thing we try not to lose sight of in this book is this is a wonderful scandal. It's filled with intrigue and deception and greed, but it's also a scandal that has real victims, and those real victims are poor people, hardworking Pakistani people all around the world who were sought out and catered to by BCCI, you know, the loss is going to range up to $15 billion. And that's hard-earned money that these people deposited at BCCI in good faith and wound up losing when this illicit bank crashed.
One of the big questions surrounding how long it took for the story of BCCI to really publicly emerge is whether federal agencies bungled it or covered the story up. Which do you think?
Well, I think our book presents a strong case for bungling, for miscommunication, for turf battles, for a failure to perceive how large this scandal was and pursue it aggressively. I mean, there have been stories put out there in the press, and, you know, certainly well-meaning stories, but I think they're stories that are only partially true or else not true at all, that there was some giant conspiracy within the Justice Department, within the federal government here to keep a lid on BCCI. I think, unfortunately, the truth is that the federal government just didn't know how to cope with a scandal this big. They didn't understand what had been uncovered down there in Tampa, Florida, by this undercover operation, and therefore they just turned their backs on it. The Federal Reserve is very ill-equipped to deal with evidence developed in a criminal probe. There was a point after the indictments came down where an IRS agent who was assigned to the Customs Task Force that did the BCCI case came up and met with a Federal Reserve official who had jurisdiction over First American Bank, and he said, BCCI owns First American Bank. I can give you 6 or 8 witnesses who will tell you that. And this Federal Reserve official said, I need more than witnesses. I need documents. And, you know, in a sense, it was a bureaucrat's response. I think that's part of the bungling of this case by the Federal Reserve. Similar things happened at the Justice Department. There was a failure to take it seriously. Now, the Justice Department changed its horses once Dick Thornburgh left and William Barr came in. They got very aggressive. They brought a major racketeering indictment against the bank itself. They won a $550 million settlement just a couple of months ago that was approved. So, you know, but it was awfully late in the game for that.
Yesterday, we had on the head of the Center for Public Integrity, and this group just issued a study on the presidential campaign advisors, the advisors to the presidential candidates. And this study showed that one of George Bush's campaign advisors is James Lake, who has also been a public relations advisor to the Abu Dhabi Investment Corporation, which is the company that had the largest ownership of BCCI. Now, Lake says he doesn't lobby for them. He just advises them on dealing with the American media. Do you think that that's a significant conflict of interest?
I do think it's a conflict of interest because conflict of interest is not only actions, but its appearance. And there's certainly the appearance of a conflict of interest here for James Lake. And I would have thought, frankly, that somebody as smart as Jim Lake would have stayed as far away as possible from BCCI. One of the sources in our book is a political consultant for another party, for the Democratic Party here in Washington. He's a very high-ranking guy. And he said he was approached by BCCI soon after the 1988 indictments. And they approached him and said, you know, we'd like for you to represent us and do a little lobbying on our behalf and just, you know, help us on public relations. And he said, I'll be happy to, but the first thing you have to do is conduct an internal investigation. I want to know how bad this scandal is. And BCCI said, well, we're not willing to do that. So he turned his back on a lot of money and walked away. And he's certainly thanking himself every single day now. But, you know, when Lake came in, the bad news was already out there on the table. I don't understand why he let himself get involved.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Douglas Franz. He's a Washington-based correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, co-author of the new book, A Full-Service Bank, which is about BCCI. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Journalist Douglas Franz is my guest, and he's co-authored a new book on the Bank of Credit and Commerce International. Well, Doug Franz, I'm going to change the subject on you and talk about a story that you broke recently for the Los Angeles Times having to do with President Bush and Saddam Hussein. And what you found was that President Bush, during his years as president and as vice president, aided Saddam Hussein before the war. Can you summarize for us what he did for Saddam Hussein?
Sure. I think it needs to be divided into two parts. When he was vice president in the Reagan administration, there was a publicly acknowledged, if not stated, tilt in American policy towards Saddam Hussein. We viewed him as a buffer to the Iranian fundamentalism, and therefore we supported him with aid throughout his 8-year war with Iran, hoping that he would contain the Ayatollah's crazies. And during that time period, George Bush, we disclosed in this, and Murray Wass was my co-author on that story, Murray and I disclosed through classified documents that George Bush played a very active role in assuring that aid to Bush. At one point in 1984, which was the first time we found Bush's fingerprints, the Iraq wanted to build a $500 million oil pipeline across Iraq to Aqaba so that it could get its oil out of Iraq and not have to go through the Strait of Hormuz, where the Iranian shipping was threatening the oil tankers. And so George Bush went to the Export-Import Bank, which is a federal agency here in Washington, and asked the president to approve this $500 million in U.S. loan guarantees so that Iraq could build this pipeline. The Export-Import Bank had been resisting that because its own economists said that Iraq wasn't creditworthy. But after George Bush went in there, that policy was reversed. The $500 million was approved. 3 years later, in 1987, the Iraqis wanted $200 million more in guarantees from the Export-Import Bank. Those guarantees had been cut off because Iraq, as expected, had not been paying its debts on earlier guarantees. But George Bush went in, telephoned the president, the new president of the Export-Import Bank, and lobbied him successfully to get this additional $200 million approved. The second phase of this occurred after Bush became president. By that time, the Iran-Iraq war was over. Iran was flat on its back. And even if you support the tilt toward Iraq during the 1980s, that was a time when most experts told Murray Wass and I that U.S. policy toward Saddam Hussein should be reevaluated. There should be a repositioning. We didn't want to make Saddam the biggest bully on the block in the Middle East. And we certainly saw ample evidence that he was becoming that. He was intent on becoming the biggest regional power in the Persian Gulf. And rather, however, than reassess our aid, we increased it and increased it. And there was, despite numerous evidences of scandal, despite intelligence reports that showed that this economic aid was being diverted for military purposes by Iraq, and despite a big brewing bank scandal here involving an Italian bank in Atlanta, the administration insisted on approving more aid for Iraq. And George Bush played an important role in that because in October 1989, he issued a national security directive ordering American U.S. agencies to increase political and economic ties with Iraq.
So you think that George Bush helped Saddam Hussein build his war machine?
Without question, U.S. aid backed and pushed by George Bush for at least 8 years was vital to Saddam's building his war machine. And it was not necessarily, Terry, that we gave him military goods, although in fact we did license $1.5 billion worth of sensitive U.S. technology to be sold to Iraq. But the important thing is here that we gave Saddam Hussein more than $5 billion in loan guarantees for food aid primarily, but that what that did was free up Saddam's hard currency so that he could spend it on the world's arms markets and build his nuclear capabilities, his biological weapons capabilities, and his chemical weapons capabilities. I mean, I don't think that there's any escaping the link between $5 billion worth of U.S. aid and the war machine that just a year ago, last week, we crushed in the Persian Gulf.
Do you think that anything in this story that you broke helps explain the personalization of the war, the way George Bush helped make this a war about George Bush versus Saddam Hussein?
Yes, that's a good question, and I think it does. And It personalizes it in a sense from Saddam Hussein's point of view, because Saddam Hussein had seen for years that George Bush was his friend. I mean, what the policy that Saddam Hussein had seen coming from George Bush personally was one of assistance, and some people have called it appeasement. So, you know, Saddam Hussein, in a sense, viewed this as personal help, and I think he was probably not crazy when he expected that the United States would not do anything when he marched into Kuwait.
What's the other significance of the information that you've uncovered?
Well, I think the other significance, Terry, is that the administration appears to have misled Congress, particularly over the motivation for this $5 billion in agricultural loan guarantees that we provided to Iraq. This is best illustrated, I think, by what happened to Senator Patrick Leahy, the chairman of the Senate Agriculture Committee. In February of 1990, Leahy heard rumors that the $1 billion that had been approved by the Agriculture Department for food aid to Iraq had been approved only after pressure was applied for foreign policy reasons. Clayton Yeider, who is now the president's domestic policy advisor at the time, was agriculture secretary, and Leahy wrote Yeider and asked him, are these rumors true? Yeider wrote back and said, oh, to the contrary, there's no foreign policy pressure involved. Well, in fact, what our stories showed, I think, in incontrovertible evidence based on classified documents as specific as talking points in James Baker's handwriting, was that the State Department and the White House National Security Council had, in fact, pressured the Agriculture Department to approve that $1 billion and hundreds of millions of dollars prior to that. You know, it was as specific as James Baker on October 31st, 1989, calling up Clayton Yeider and asking him to approve the full $1 billion, which had been opposed by the Agriculture Department. And Yeider, in Baker's own handwriting on this classified document, Baker said, Yeider responded, I think we see it your way, I'll get involved. Soon after that, the full $1 billion was ultimately approved.
What reverberations has the story had?
Well, it's interesting. They've been both what we expected and less than we expected. They've been what we expected in the sense that the congressmen, particularly, who feel they were lied to, read this and have been outraged. Congressman Henry Gonzalez from Texas, the chairman of the House Banking Committee, has entered two large reports in the Congressional Record and plans hearings on this subject. Patrick Leahy also plans to do an investigation through the Agricultural Committee. There's been some outrage in Congress. What's interesting, though, Terry, is that the rest of the nation's press hasn't followed up on this at all. It's very easy for the press to follow up after the Star gives us the Jennifer Flowers, Bill Clinton story. But they're not willing, it seems to me, to go the extra step and try and follow up on a substantive series of stories that go to questions of Reagan and Bush administration judgment on key foreign policy issues, particularly when they're so directly related to the events that led us to the Persian Gulf War.
Okay. Douglas Franz, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
And Douglas Franz is a Washington-based reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He's also co-author of the new book, A Full-Service Bank. It's about the BCCI, and it's just been published by Pocket Books. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.